We are on the second series and we have to read the 26 chapters. 26th chapter is the synthesis of knowledge and devotion. Last time we read a very interesting chapter on the two natures. So the Bhagavad Gita has given many unique kinds of thought, and its attempt to synthesize the different strands of Indian spiritual paths, Indian spiritual thinking. So one of them being the dichotomy or the gap between the creation and the creator, which was created by this idea that or the experience that there is the immutable Brahman as the reality and this world is Maya, it's an illusion. So whatever be the meaning of illusion, we are not going into it because there are different ways one can understand it. But an unbridgeable gulf remained. Who is Maya? How she came into existence? How could she cloud Brahman? That's a very interesting question. And who put us here and who is here actually? If we are not the ego, in fact, if we are nothing, then who is striving? So all these many questions which remained unresolved, so the Gita answers us. And is there a point of contact between we who are stuck here apparently and the creator who is beyond in that state of immutable sarva sakshi suryo yatha sarva lokasya chakshu? So that's where the two natures resolves this problem, that the divine and his shakti are one. And Shri Krishna uses the word his yog maya, he uses the word para prakriti. So there is another prakriti which is other than this prakriti of three gunas. This is the first important thought. So how are we connected to this para prakriti? Here it is not revealed just now. Sri Aurobindo would reveal it, that it is the, just as the jiva, it is the divine, the purusha who has become the jiva, who has become this in purushas here that we experience. Similarly, it is the para prakriti that has become this prakriti. But that thought the Gita doesn't, it withholds right now, only hints at it. And it hints at it by saying that in all the movements of nature, in all the becomings, bhutani, if you go to the core, the essence, it is the divine. So that the extension of jnana into vijnana. That's how the Gita speaks of the jnana vijnana. And it speaks about essence being smell, taste, all these different experiences. So all these is at the core. It is because of the divine presence that these experiences take place due to a combination of nature, the gunas and the self. So this what we read last time. Also the second point of contact between the para prakriti and this creation is the jiva and the swabhava. So this also we had read. So para prakriti has become the jiva, jiva bhuta. So she is the mother of our souls and each individual soul is a child of the divine mother. And within the child, within the jiva, there is as if the original programming of what it should become. So in life we experience two kinds of becomings. By becomings means as the change and evolution. One is the original blueprint which is there in the jiva. So the original blueprint is how, what aspect of the divine, what mode of the divine we are born to manifest. For instance, some people are born to manifest truth, some are born to manifest justice, some are born to manifest love. Each of this is an aspect of the divine. On the other hand, there is the covering of the ignorance which deflects and deviates this. So you want to manifest justice, but you end up with a job where you are making money, or even if you take to becoming a judge, you are into ambition rather than justice. So basically the deflecting element is there in lower nature which deflects us from the true purpose. So to find the true purpose, we have to get rid of all these rajoguni pravartis whose names are ambition, lust, anger, greed, desire, fear. Because of this, the true sabhava and swadharma is unable to manifest. So this is the second part which is important, which Sri Aurobindo reveals to us. So on this basis, he goes on to the next chapter. He has already synthesized knowledge and works in the first six chapters. and only hinted at bhakti. So, work, we are all engaged in work, but that is not karma yoga. Karma yoga is yoga, means work becomes a means of union with the divine, and the union takes place through knowledge, means we have to first disengage from the fruits, the strong grip of the desired self, then we begin to live in the immutable Brahman. This is the first step. So then what do we do next? So now the works are done as a sacrifice to the eternal. So we already see a seed of bhakti being there, because who is the eternal? He is a being, the being of Purushottama. Is this how Sri Krishna begins to synthesize devotion and knowledge alongside? Because if the supreme reality is only a Brahman, impersonal Brahman, then there is no point of contact, there is no bhakti element involved in it. But bhakti is as much a demand of our natural being as anything else, because we have three basic psychological constituents within us. Even modern psychology speaks of it. Conative, cognitive and affective. So conative is will. This one component within us, in our psychological apparatus. So how to uplift that will to its highest possibility? Through karma yoga. Progressively disengage the will from the desire element and more join it to the divine will. So when mother was asked that, you know, if divine will is doing everything, do we have to any role of our will? She says yes, because otherwise that will obstruct the working. If we say that divine is doing everything, therefore I should not use my will, then my will become an obstacle in the working of the divine will. Because it's a component. So that will, by progressively disengaging it from the desired self, by the will to serve the higher purpose, the true purpose, this will begins to get aligned with the divine will. The second element is the mind and its seeking for knowledge. This another aspect. But knowledge is normally confined to superficial appearances, because it's based on the input from the senses. All our judgments, all that based on our preconceived ideas, notions, conditioning, we draw conclusions. It's almost automatic and we call it knowledge. And to all this source, now we have a new source of knowledge, which is WhatsApp University, we all know. So that's very easy. Anything comes on WhatsApp is true. So first we have to develop discernment. Without discernment, we cannot grow in knowledge. The discernment between what is true and what is false. And then this discernment has to be lifted up through an aspiration, through the process of sacrifice, yajna, refine it till our mind begins to become a receptacle of God knowledge, the truth above. So therefore the mind also changes into a true vehicle and vessel of knowledge. So this knowledge and works. But what about the heart? So a typical Gyan yogi will say heart has to be just dried. It's a no real role. It is the one which deludes you. So you will see there are people who are very wary of the heart. Heart is a problem creator, not a solver. So solution has to come by the mind and intelligence, but heart, don't engage with heart. But heart is a very much a part of us. So what about heart? Here again we see that we love appearances, we are engaged with the appearances. So heart has to learn to see the divine in all things and everywhere. But how is it going to see the divine if the divine is only an immutable Brahman? That's the problem. We know he is all impersonal, somewhere out there, no outreach from his side. All that we can do is reach there. He offers no support in a typical Jnana Yoga. But because the Purushottama, the Uttamam Purusha, is beyond the Akshar and the Akshar, therefore there is a point of contact and there is a meaning in worship. So this is the whole basis on which this chapter unfolds itself. So if you go through the typical Jnana Yoga, so we'll find that love, bhakti is given a very subordinate place. It's only to prepare the mind, because it's apparently engaged in outwardly some prayers and some meditation. So it is prepared. One day it has to discard it, because it becomes one with the self. But there is something still beyond. That's what Gita is revealing to us. This is chapter 7. We'll run through this series over a few chapters. That's how Sri Aurobindo follows in the essays, the scheme. So we are on the synthesis of devotion and knowledge on page 278. The second passage. We have before us three parts. The Purushottama as the supreme truth of that into which we have to grow, the self and the jiva. So the self is also Brahman, spoken of as Brahman. So we have different terminologies. So one is the antaratma, the atma and the paramatma. So the Gita is following its own terminology, shar, the divine in the mutable becoming, the jiva. And then there is the divine who is immutable, which is atma, the self, with the capital S. And then there is the Purushottama. So these are the three. In Christian tradition, it would be the Father, Son and the Holy Spirit. That's how. So there are different traditions in which these three layers or levels at which the divine exists simultaneously. It's not like he is there and not here. He is simultaneously, there are three modes. Like in a human being, at once one can be father, at once one can be a son, and at once one can be a worker in the in whatever profession one is. So it doesn't, it's not either or. It's what one puts forth. So, and then something very beautiful. Or as we may put it, there is the supreme, there is the impersonal spirit, and there is the multiple soul, timeless foundation of our spiritual personality, the true and eternal individual, Mamai Vansha Sanatana. So this, as we have already discussed this, that there are people who debate whether individual soul has a reality or not. The whole point is, if there is nothing which is in us as a representative of the divine, individually, then all effort collapses. Who is then getting free? Certainly not the ego personality. So there is the truth of the individual soul which is being revealed to us. So there is a false individuality or a constructed individuality. Let's not call it false because it serves a purpose. And there is the true individuality. The false or the constructed individuality is the ego personality. It is certain name, form, job. It is created by nature through whatever conditioning from environment, from society. But behind it, there is the true individual. And first step is to uncover it. So this is the thought we have here. And in Sri Aurobindo's yoga, of course, this is the psychic being. All these three are divine. All three are the divine. The supreme spiritual nature of being, the para prakriti, free from any limitation by the conditioning ignorance, is the nature of the Purushottama. So that's why divine action is so difficult to understand, because he doesn't act according to any rule or format. So yesterday someone was asking, what is the difference between Rama and Krishna? So are they both not Purushottama? So Sri Krishna is Purushottama. He declares himself as the Purushottama. Who is Rama? Rama is Maryada Purushottama. So the same infinite consciousness limits itself to the human mold. So he doesn't openly declare. Whereas Sri Krishna breaks that mold. Rama builds the ideal human mold of an ideal human being, because we have to first become that, that Gita will tell us. Then we go beyond it. Then we are in the freedom of the spirit. So some people take it the other way around. Oh, we are free, we are free, we are free to do anything, whatever I feel like doing. Then we are going straight to the animal nature. So there are two kinds of freedom. One, the animal freedom, apparent freedom. It's conditioned completely by nature. And there is the true freedom, the freedom of the spirit, the freedom which we find in Sri Krishna's life and of course in Sri Aurobindo and the mother's life. In the impersonal self, there is the same divine nature, but here it is in its state of eternal rest, equilibrium, inactivity, nivritti. It is this divine nature held back in the Brahman, which it put forth as Maya, Vidyamai and Avidyamai, which will build forms and names. Finally, for activity, for pravritti, the para prakriti becomes the multiple spiritual personality, the jiva. So that's for the manifestation. The very purpose of individuality is to manifest the divine. So it completely changes our perspective that the soul is trapped in ignorance, it has to escape, enter into nirvana, be done with life and birth and death. We have to discover the soul, tune the nature, lower nature to the para prakriti, and become instrument of a divine action in the world. So it changes the whole thing. So a few lines below on page 279. Therefore it follows that in action the effort of the human individual must be to get back to his true spiritual personality and to make all his works flow from the power of its supernal shakti. So all the practices of yoga, getting rid of desire, ego self, is essentially first to discover the spiritual person within us, which is the psychic being, and to let the divine shakti work in us and not the desired self. So, and when the divine shakti works, it works in complete freedom. Neither your mind nor your action can be limited to any fixed format. All those rules are necessary at one level of our evolution. But when we enter into the higher evolution, then all these collapse because something new is beginning to come up. And that's why we see Sri Aurobindo hardly gave any rules. He gave only one rule. Always behave as if the mother is looking at you because she is indeed always present. That's it. With regard to food, same thing he said. No prescriptions and prescriptions except the one prescription. The mother is there, and only the psychic being can realize this truth, not just intellectually, but as a living presence. And it can solve so many problems. Just to imagine that, even to imagine that the mother is with us, what fear, what kind of desire can strike? Because she is there. Does a child has to bother? Mama, have you kept this for me? Mama, have you kept that for me? Child is playing in the lap of the Divine Mother. Mother is planning everything, isn't it? So when we discover the psychic being and are given to the Divine Mother, then we don't have to worry about anything. We know spontaneously that she is there and she'll take care of whatever is needed. So this is the first step of the yoga. Then in the next passage, he shows us step by step. But there is also this lower nature of the three gunas, whose character is the character of ignorance. So this is where the problem now comes. That while all this is fine, but we instinctively act according to the lower nature. And what is the hallmark of lower nature is the rajasic egoism. So we are driven by ego, we are driven by desires, lusts, greed of different kinds. And as long as we are driven by that, we have what is called as the proclivity towards sin. So sin is not a concept, frankly speaking, in Indian thought. But what is sin is not do's and don'ts of life. It's not like if you take meat, you are doing a sin. You may be a vegetarian, but you may be a glutton who is, robbing things and storing inside, you are doing a sin. Because all rajasic egoism is the birthplace of sin. So that is described on the next page. But before that, we read the last line on this page 279. Yielding to passion, an active or an inert indulgence of sin is no way either to the spiritual quietism of the highest impersonality or to the spiritual activity of the divine individual. Why is this important? Because people say, I am not this nature, I am the divine. So that means they make this, draw this conclusion, I can do anything with impunity because the divine is beyond good and evil. So that's not the way to really become an instrument of the divine action. That it doesn't matter whether I kill or don't kill. And they quote the Gita, which is obviously a grave error. It's literally the devil quoting the scripture. That I'm not this lower nature. So therefore, I can do whatever I feel like, or I can be in that state of freedom. Even Shankaracharya ji describes four types of nature which can emerge when you are connected with that higher consciousness. You leave the nature. So nature can go into inert mode. Jadvat. You're just sitting. That's it. Doing nothing. or it can become balvat, like a child. No format. Child has no format. May behave like that. Or it may become like a madman, unmattavat. Or it can even become like a ghaul, pishachvat. All this is described. So while this is true, it is possible, but this is not Sri Aurobindo's yoga nor the yoga of the Gita. So there are people who follow that path. But here, Sri Aurobindo says, that is not the way. What is the way? Or to the spiritual activity of the divine individual, who is to be a channel for the will of the Supreme Person, a direct power and visible becoming of the Purushottama. So we have to embody the divine as vessels and vehicle and channels, flawless and faithful instruments, crystal clear channels for his working upon the world. This is the original plan, that each element, each individual becomes the divine, not only in his essence, but in the manifestation. This is the whole purpose. So, what is the step? Because normally we are completely clouded, so it defines sin on the next page. So, what is sin? Sin is the working of the lower nature for the crude satisfaction of its own ignorant, dull or violent rajasic and tamasic propensities in revolt against any high self-control and self-mastery of the nature by the spirit. There is no external marker. That's why people say, but Arjun is also killing. So why do you say that this killing is all right? But when Duryodhan and Karna is killing, it's not okay. People ask, because in Indian thought, it's not the action but the motive and the intention and the spirit behind. So when Arjun is killing, he is killing in a state of complete surrender to the divine will. He is not killing because he wants money, wealth or kingdom to build an empire. He is not doing out of that. Though as a Kshatriya, it is his dharma to conquer and to govern those kingdoms in the highest possible way. Even that could be a Ashwamedh Yajna, the wars which were fought to establish another kind of order, to build empires, but based on dharma. Even that is valid. But he is not killing because of that. Whereas Duryodhan and his army are killing only to build their own empire by unjust means. Therefore, this killing is okay and that killing is not. So it's not the action, but the inner intent, the spirit, the motive, or if you want to use a modern term, attitude, a state of consciousness in which an act is done, that it is regarded as sin. And in order to get rid of this crude compulsion of the being by the lower prakriti in its inferior modes, we must have recourse to the highest mode of that prakriti, the sattvic, which is seeking always for a harmonious light of knowledge and for a right rule of action. So first, Rajotamagun have to be replaced by Sattva. Sattvagun, when it develops in man, then he seeks a higher ethic, a nobler way of life. It's inevitable. So the moment the Sattvagun develops, what is called in ancient India as Brahmanatva and Kshatriyatva, one seeks a right rule of action. One doesn't want to act according to all kinds of social notions and conventional ideas, or under the impulse of desires and under the impulse of excitement, because everybody is shooting, you also go and shoot. You know, it's famous story in Bengal. I don't know whether, particularly Kolkata, I have lived there. So when the crowd is there and they are beating a person, and an ordinary man is passing by, he has to ask, well, what happened? No, we don't know. This man, and they are beating. So, as the story goes, the passerby will also give him two and go away, believing that he deserves to be beaten. So this is in complete unthinking, mass activity, riots. Many people don't even know that what is the cause. They do dharnas. They don't know why they are doing what they are doing. And of course, not to speak of the grosser things. So this has to be first brought under a sattvic control. So even they've been on the ashram, there was an attack, you must be knowing. So one of them was asked, why are you doing? He said, no, he revealed the truth. We are getting a bottle and a plate of meat biryani, that's enough. And 100 rupees, sorry. So that's his motive. So this is the state has to be first brought in under a sattvic control. Some kind of self-master. You don't act because everybody is doing that. You begin to separate yourself from that. Sattva is also lower nature, but nature has made this step for us to rise. So first under a noble ethic. So that's where Maryada Purushottam Ram comes in. He doesn't act only on impulse. He acts by a deliberate reflection, thought. He seeks harmony. He tries even with Ravan to create a harmony. When it fails, then he fights. So the two, we can see the contrast here. So the first thing is the sattvic will in our nature has to govern us and not the rajasic and tamasic will. Tamasic will is blind action, completely thoughtless, driven by the masses. And rajasic will is driven by personal gains, personal advantages, setting a score, setting your score. So all that. And right in the beginning, the Gita clarifies, the evil doers attain not to me, says the Purushottama, souls bewildered, low in the human scale, for their knowledge is reft away from them by Maya, and they resort to the nature of being of the Asura. So now he is describing the Asura. Asura has nothing to do with two horns and, saying, ha ha, not those gross bodies the way it is shown. Asuras, some Asuras may look very nice outwardly. But here comes the catch. The evil doer cannot attain to the supreme because he is forever trying to satisfy the idle ego. On the lowest scale of human nature, his real God is this ego. His mind and will, hurried away in the activities of the Maya of the three gunas, are not instruments of the spirit, but willing slaves or self-deceived tools of his desires. Last line. To serve ego and desire without aspiration to a higher nature and a higher law is to have the mind and the temperament of the asura. You may be working in an ashram, in a temple, or any which where. It doesn't matter. You may be a pandit, you may be a so-called learned person, but you are eyeing on the money. You are eyeing on how you will become the Mahamandaleshwar. It's true. You have to see all this once. In Jorhat, I was having a chat with one of the wealthy people and just casual chat over tea, and I was just in a mood to talk about Bhagavat. So we kept speaking for 2 hours, 3 hours on Bhagavat, stories of Krishna. Then at the end, she says, do you charge for it? I said, such a delight, so much delight, why should I charge for it? And then she says, we have Bhagavat Kathas. And the stuff is so standard, usual, substandard, because it's the same stock things, and they charge heavily. So this was 2003. So I asked her, how much they charge? Said 1 lakh rupees, but not in cash. Nowadays, because they may be charged income tax, so they want in other ways. I said, what are these other ways you give money? You can imagine what state. They don't want check to be given. They want you to withdraw the money and give you literally black. Now, imagine a person who is speaking of Bhagavat Katha. Who is speaking of the glories of God Krishna. This is the state. So, whom is he serving? Not Krishna. He is serving his own ego. And therefore it is sin. Look at how Sri Aurobindo and Sri Krishna clearly, crystal clear. So, sin is rajasic egoism and tamasic will. This is the temperament of the asura. So, first necessity is to train to obey the higher law. And that's why disciplining has its own purposes. Because, especially with children, I see freedom means, let them do anything. They are not equipped to do everything. Till 15, you have to gradually, they have to learn that there is something higher, greater. Okay. People are not perfect, but just this training in this school of obedience, Shivindu describes in Savitri, then you are free, then you are a master. But people who say whatever the child wants, you give the child, it's cool. It's not cool because you are training the child into becoming a full-blown asura. So that basic training, basic disciplining is needed to grow into a higher being. It doesn't immediately help you, but it helps you to at least develop the sattvic mode of working. And then you can go further to the spiritual. So, on page 281, few lines below, still by the constant upward, so he says that yes, sattva is not enough, but it's the first necessary step. Still by the constant upward aspiration in his ethical aim, he in the end gets rid of the obscuration of sin, which is the obscuration of rajasic desire and passion, and acquires a purified nature capable of deliverance from the rule of the triple Maya. By virtue alone, man cannot attain to the highest, but by virtue, he can develop a first capacity for attaining to it, adhikar. That's why when we read Sri Aurobindo's writings on education, when he talks about moral nature, it's true that divine is beyond moral and ethical. But hardly anyone can spare himself not to go through this stage. You have to go through this stage. See, this is how in Indian society it was at one point of time. We had the sanskaras and, you know, certain things. So it was a training. Now, when you reach a certain point, even certain religious things, they were part of training. Then you enter into the freedom of the spirit where there is no more rules. But you want to jump that step. So if you touch at all, if one touches at all the higher realms, the nature can enter into a very chaotic state because it cannot hold that tremendous energy. It's not disciplined, it's not organized. So this is where Sri Aurobindo beautifully, by virtue alone, man cannot attain to the highest. But by virtue, he can develop a first capacity for attaining to it. So man has to first become ethical. So this is where we can turn the page. Now comes the aspect of bhakti. So whose bhakti? What does it mean? So you can do bhakti of the divine in a very limited way. Or you can ennoble the bhakti into a universalized image of the divine. I remember once going to, my first glimpse of the mother's picture was in a Rajasri production film, Dosti. So they used to, Tarachand Barjatya, he was a devotee and he would dedicate his films to the mother. So first time we went to watch this movie and it came, that time I had just started reading Sri Aurobindo and the mother a little. And it came, the mother of Sri Aurobindo Ashram Pondicherry. I don't know why it jarred. I was super happy to see the mother's picture in a movie. At the same time, I said, only of Sri Aurobindo Ashram Pondicherry. Like we have limited her. She is too vast. Instinctively, I didn't know anything actually of mother's life, frankly speaking. Slowly you begin to discover. So this can be a starting point, but it cannot be an ending point. And that's where now Gita is leading us to the universal vision of the Godhead. You cannot confine him to a sect, a cult, only to a place, only to one figure, one form. And it's a very vast vision it is going to open before us. So we'll move toward that on page 282. Last two sentences. This process of growing into the spirit completes our purification. But while this is being done, while the soul is enlarging into self-knowledge, it is also to increase in devotion. So what is increasing in devotion? Is it like spending all the time in the temple and doing this puja? No. For it has not only to act in a large spirit of equality, but to do also sacrifice to the Lord, to that Godhead in all beings, which it does not yet know perfectly, but which it will be able so to know integrally. And this is a very, very powerful word, samagrama, in totality, not just in a limited way. When it is firmly the vision of the one self everywhere and in all existences, equality and vision of unity once perfectly gained, A supreme bhakti, an all-embracing devotion to the divine, becomes the whole and the sole law of the being. So this is Sri Aurobindo's starting point of his yoga. In fact, before he begins the yoga, he has the vision of Vasudevam Sarvamiti. And if you read yoga and its objects, he says the first practice of yoga is equanimity, nishkam karma, and to see the one self, divine self, everywhere and in all things. And then he says, not only as a static presence, but in all the circumstances and situations of life. So this is the baseline. All the rest is later. So this is the practice. And how to do it? That also he explains. By the constant insistence of the idea, the will and faith are the two instruments. So when the idea keeps on, the divine is in all is in the divine is all. There is a constant ongoing meditation on this idea. The will is striving towards it. And there is the faith that such a reality exists. Then one day the appearance is open and then God is everywhere. So this is the state where bhakti really begins in the true sense. A supreme bhakti, an all-embracing devotion to the divine. All other law of conduct merges into that surrender. Sarvadharman parityajya. So it is only when we are able to see the divine everywhere and in all beings. The soul then becomes firm in this bhakti and in the vow of self-consecration of all its being, knowledge, works. For it has now for its sure base, its absolute foundation of existence, and action, the perfect, the integral, the unifying knowledge of the all originating Godhead, or Bhajante Maam Dridvrita. So, Mother puts it in a very simple way. She says, you cannot do the integral yoga if you take it as a part-time thing that, okay, when I am inside the ashram. She doesn't use the word ashram, but she says, when I am in meditation, then I will be like this. But when I go out with my friends and when I am moving in the park and, you know, playing a game, then I can afford to forget. That's not how things work. So we have to feel and experience and have at least the idea to start with that she is everywhere and in everything. It's a very powerful meditation, one of the ones which I have found very, very powerful. This half a phrase of the Upanishad which Sri Aurobindo would in the Alipur jail, walking from the courtyard, from the prisoners' crafts and to the goshala where the cows were there, he would walk and he would constantly repeat Sarvakhalvidam Brahman, Sarvakhalvidam Brahman, Sarvakhalvidam Brahman. All this is the Brahman. So I have my own modification of it. Sarvakhalvidam Mataram, Sarvakhalvidam Mataram. I don't know Sanskrit why it is correct or not, but I like to see that divine mother everywhere, that impulsion of Shakti. Then a time comes when that's how he sees in the judge, in the prosecuting, the opponent, everywhere he sees the divine. So who will worry? Where will worry, anxiety, fears? Where will they they will vanish? So this is the baseline. Then we see on the next page, this is the, of course, well known, where the Gita describes four kinds of bhakta. First, he has already told us those who are going to God or going to religious temples, places, only for aggrandizing their ego, satisfying their ambition, are asuras. That's out. So don't count them among bhakti. They may go every day to a temple. Once somebody asked Sri Aurobindo, but X goes every day to the temple. He seems a very religious person. And Sri Aurobindo says, many asuras are very religious. It's so true. Look at Ravan, the kind of tapasya he did. Many of us cannot imagine, fellow is chopping off his head. And Brahma is putting it back because he knows actually his intention is not good. But I think after 10 times even he gets tired, he says, okay, ask. Because by then he knows now what is the curve which is going to take place. He says, okay, ask. What does he ask after all this? He should have asked, take away all these heads and make me yours. But what does he ask? He asks for immortality and king of all the worlds. So at the end point, this is what matters, the core aspiration. Why we are doing whatever we are doing. So that has to be kept away. So he starts by saying, on page 284, where the after the break, the passage begins, For note that it is bhakti with knowledge which the Gita demands from the disciples. So knowledge is that the divine is everywhere and in everything. So this is the knowledge of oneness. It regards all other forms of devotion as good in themselves, but still inferior. They may do well by the way, but they are not the thing at which it aims in the soul's culmination. So then, what are these four kinds of bhaktas which the Gita speaks of? We all know, but it's beautiful to read it. Among those who have put away the sin of the rajasic egoism. So first, that is the starting point. If you want to live only to aggrandize your ego, forget about bhakti, etc. Because you are basically serving your own ego. So first step is putting away the sin of rajasic egoism. So among those, and are moving toward the divine, the Gita distinguishes between four kinds of bhaktas. So there is, after having done this, then comes this four kinds of bhakti. This qualifier is important. And what are these? There are those who turn to him as a refuge from sorrow and suffering in the world. Arth. So we have in the Bhagavad the story of even the elephant who is caught by the graha. It's a very symbolic story also. That however mighty you may be, strong, elephant is formidable creature on land, yet you may suddenly come in the grip of the forces of the inconscient and the subconscious, which the crocodile represents. And at that point, he cries to the Lord and he comes. So this is Arth. He's not a yogi but there is a point of distress. It's a distress SOS call to the divine. Thankfully, it doesn't matter how you call him. It's your own connect. And we are so lucky that we don't even have to use a formal mantra. Ma is enough. The word that a child learns as the child is born. Or simply mother. Why mother? Because Sri Aurobindo has used the word mother. So it's just this way of looking at it. Ma is the word we learn naturally. Om we learn later. So simply ma, even a cow knows how to say ma. So that's Arth, distress call. There are those who seek him as the giver of good in the world. Arth, Arthi. I want this, I want that, I want money, I want success. People have even gone and said that I want a good partner. Not knowing that such a thing, probably ideal partner, out of format. But divine says, okay. But these things are not permanent. So he grants you so that you understand what you asked for. Someone asked Sri Aurobindo, why does the divine grant these things? If he knows that you have to ultimately get rid of desire, why does he grant you your desire? He says, well, so that you can learn from experience that it was not worth it. But you have to learn it. You have to have it and then. It's different from never having a rasgulla. So as they say about marriage, that it's better to repent after marriage than not marrying at all and keep dreaming of an ideal. So it's all right. You have the rasgulla and you realize that, well, it is not really worth it. So this is the whole logic of Artharthi. Why the divine grants, even though he knows that no desire can actually satisfy or fulfill our deepest quest. Artharthi. There are those who come to him in the desire for knowledge, jigyasu, who want to know him, his principles. And lastly, there are those who adore him with knowledge, jnani. So traditionally, the first two are divided as inferior or lower forms of bhakti. They are not bhakti of a yogi. And the other two are regarded as higher forms of bhakti. But the Gita would say the highest is the jnani. He knows. So whom does he really do the bhakti? So that's where comes the play of the eternal individual and the eternal. For the joy of the delight of the being and the becoming. He can merge. But there is this double delight. Not only of being one with the divine in the essence. But in the manifestation being a participant. So this is the highest kind of bhakti, that of the jnani. And as Sri Aurobindo says in the last line. We may say that these forms are successively the bhakti of the vital, emotional and affective nature. So, this we know that, Arth, the emotions cry out to him. that of the practical and dynamic nature, artharthi, seeking for material goods, page 285, that of the reasoning intellectual nature, the jigyasu, and that of the highest intuitive being, which takes up all the rest of the nature into unity with the divine, which is jnani. So what is jnani's bhakti? He is not satisfied just inwardly joining with God. He wants to see and unite everywhere and in every form. There is a very nice little line from a song which I had heard long back. So it's in Bengali. So the poet says, I'll translate in English. Amar eke Krishna mon bhore na, ami ananta Krishna dube chahi. I am not satisfied with one Krishna. I want infinite Krishnas to drown myself. So it's not enough to discover God within or discover God in a certain form. You have to universalize the divine in all beings. And that makes life really delightful. So that's where he is taking us. Practically, however, the others may be regarded as preparatory movements. So Sri Krishna is not discarding them. For the Gita itself here says that it is only at the end of many existences that one can, after possession of the integral knowledge and after working that out in oneself through many lives, attain at the long last to the transcendent. For the knowledge of the divine as all things that are is difficult to attain, and rare on earth is the great soul, Mahatma, that is, not Mahatma as we have started calling all kinds of people Mahatma, but soul is Atma, Mahatma. So what is that soul? Samahatma cha durlabha. This is the verse he is referring to. And what is that Mahatma? Vasudevam sarvamiti. He who sees the one divine everywhere. Vasudev, the one who, the immanent divine. He who sees him in the blue of the sky, in the green of the forest. What is it? In the blue of the sky, in the green of the forest. Who was it? Who has painted the glow? Who is it roused them and painted the glow? When the winds were asleep in the womb of the ether, who was it roused them and made them to blow? In the strength of a man, in the beauty of woman, in the laughter of boy, in the blush of a girl, the hand that sent Jupiter spinning through heaven, spent all its cunning to fashion a curl. But these are his works and his ways and his shadows. But who is he then? By what name is he known? Is he Brahma or Vishnu, man or a woman, bodied or bodiless, twin or alone? So you have to keep on deepening and universalizing. It starts with a simple act of, oh, this is such a divine moment. But then whole life, that moment has to extend itself. So this is, he uses the word sarvavit, sarvabhavin. By all your aspects of nature, you join with the divine. And then he answers that it may be asked, how is that devotion high and noble, udar, which seeks God only for the worldly boons he can give, or as a refuge in sorrow and suffering, and not the divine for its own sake? Do not egoism, weakness, desire reign in such an adoration? And does it not belong to the lower nature? Now here, it's very interesting that there are questions which Arjun doesn't ask, which is a sign that they are actually on the battlefield. So they just have about 2 hours given to them. But Sri Aurobindo raises these questions for posterity. Because Sri Krishna says, it's also all are these are udara bhakti. Noble, any kind of bhakti, even when you're seeking for your own good. Moreover, where there is not knowledge, the devotee does not approach the divine in his integral, all-embracing truth. Vasudevaha sarvamiti. But constructs imperfect names and images of the Godhead, which are only reflections of his own need, temperament and nature. And he worships them to help or appease his natural longings. He constructs for the Godhead the name and form of Indra or Agni, of Vishnu or Shiva, or a divinized Christ or Buddha, or else some composite of natural qualities. So this is another thing that many people who are iconoclast, they destroy these, that you know, these are inferior. Now Sri Krishna, the wisest of the wise, doesn't do it. He doesn't do. He knows these are steps to climb to the ladder. So if you do it, then a person in all likelihood will not discover the transcendent. In all likelihood, he will go into a state of inconscient, where everything is a hodgepodge and mixture. Therefore, Sri Aurobindo answers it, that, you know, God of righteousness, God of love and mercy, God who punishes strange things, but anyways, so a sectarian sanction for an erring, dogmatic, intellectual, intolerant knowledge. All this up to a certain point is true enough. So these are very imperfect forms of knowledge and imperfect forms of worship. So why does the divine sanction it? So Sri Aurobindo says, very rare is the great soul who knows that Vasudeva, the omnipresent being, is all that is. Vasudeva sarvamiti samahatma chadu sadurlabha. Men are led away by various outer desires which take from them the working of the inner knowledge. And that's why he who knows, he will not confuse people by saying Shiva is greater, Krishna is greater, Vishnu is greater. Nor will he confuse by saying all these are one. All these are aspects of the one, representing some aspect or the other. So to that extent, it's okay. You can, whatever aspect you are drawn to, you can do that. And the Godhead accordingly responds. The last line on page 286, paragraph where it is ending. But those who adore the transcendent and integral Godhead embrace all this and transform it all. Exalt the gods to their highest, nature to her summits, and go beyond them to the very Godhead. Realize and attain to the transcendent. So this is the Samagra Mam, this aspect of totality and completeness which we find in the Gita, integrality. So, according to the nature, last line on this page, if then, after thus bewildering them with his workings in nature, he were not to meet them in all, these at all, there would be no divine hope for man or for any soul in Maya. So these steps are important. Sattva is important. Worshipping limited partial godheads is important. Limited worship is important. Otherwise, there would be no... I mean, we all have crossed these in our previous lives and come here. Therefore, according to their nature, as they approach him, he accepts their bhakti. So, this there in the chapter 7. As men approach to me in whatsoever faith, so I receive them. And the mother says that it's so important, this faith. If you believe that the divine will wipe away all your errors, he will do it at 10,000 times. But if you believe he is cruel and punishes you, you will experience him like that. Because that is necessary for your nature at this point of time. If you believe that he can carry you throughout the journey, he will carry you throughout the journey. And if you believe that he separates and unites, then you will experience the divine like that. So she says, you don't know how important is faith. So the Gita is expressing the same truth. As is man's faith, so I respond to them. In fact, he says, I strengthen that faith. You have to go through that approach. Therefore, according to the nature, as they approach him, he accepts their bhakti and answers to it with the reply of divine love and compassion. These forms are after all a certain kind of manifestation through which the imperfect human intelligence can touch him. These desires are first means by which our souls turn towards him. Nor is any devotion worthless or ineffective, whatever its limitation. Somebody once asked me that, you know, I used to pray and immediately mother would grant me whatever I would pray. Now it doesn't happen. So she asked me why. I said, because she has taken you seriously now. Now she is promoting you to the higher class. Because this is something we all like, a divine who is granting us prayers. But divine who takes away our desire, that is very difficult. So first, how does he do? He doesn't grant. So now you are caught. You can't leave him because you have started loving the fellow. He was granting desires. Then slowly what does he do? He takes away the desire. And you say, I love you for your own sake. not for anything that you may give. So this is how the whole yoga proceeds, or the divine takes us. So he says, these desires are first means by which our souls turn towards him. It has the one grand necessity, faith. Through all this, you need faith. Whatever form of me any devotee with faith desires to worship, I make that faith of his firm and undeviating. By the force of that faith in his cult and worship, he gets his desire and the spiritual realization for which he is at the moment fitted. But he also says that anyways I am the one who is granting. But this I is not the limited Krishna. It's a Purushottama on the battlefield. It's a super conscious state during which Sri Krishna reveals the Gita. Shivinda writes that it is in that state. So that time it is the transcendent I, supreme, who is speaking. So what does he say? He says, doesn't matter. You pray to, mother has said something like that. When you pray to Shiva, it is me who you pray. When you pray to Durga, it is me you pray. So it all reaches to her and she grants. So whenever one is identified with that highest, this is how one finds oneself in everyone and in everything. By depending, by seeking all is good from the divine, he shall come in the end to seek in the divine all is good. How beautiful this is. So after some time you begin to love, doesn't matter. It's like in the beginning, you know, when two people live together, they are calculating advantage. If you carry on sufficiently long enough, you say it's okay. you begin to love with all the things. So by the force of that faith, okay, yeah. By knowing the divine in his forms and qualities, he shall come to know him as the all and the transcendent, who is the source of all things. Thus, by his spiritual development, devotion becomes one with knowledge. So what is this knowledge? That in everyone and everything, there is this divine presence. That Purushottama. Knowledge here in yoga is oneness. Knowledge is not a book knowledge. That is called Panditya in Indian thought. One may have read all the books, written many books, given many lectures, but that doesn't make knowledge. Knowledge is oneness, to discover that oneness. Ignorance is division. That's why the highest ignorance is to divide world and God. Knowledge is oneness, to reclaim the world as God. That's why there's the highest knowledge. Thus, by spiritual development, devotion becomes one with knowledge. The jiva comes to delight in the one Godhead, in the divine known as all being and consciousness and delight, and as all things and beings and happenings, known in nature, known in the self, known for that which exceeds self and nature. He is ever in constant union with him, nitya yukta. His whole life and being are in eternal yoga with the transcendent, than whom there is nothing other, nothing higher, with the universal besides whom there is none else and nothing else. So this is the ultimate acme of bhakti. He transcends all and he has become all this. So then obviously you are never alone, because wherever you are, she is there. You are one with her, with the divine. On him is concentrated all his bhakti, ek bhakti hi, not on any partial godhead, rule or cult. This single devotion to his whole law of living, and he has gone beyond all creeds of religious belief, rules of conduct, personal aims of life. He has no griefs to be healed, for he is in possession of the all blissful. If you ask a person who is joined with the divine, you can share, somebody once asked, you can take me as a friend and share whatever sorrows or problems sometimes. You must be also having some. I felt like having a hearty laugh. I said, once mother is with you, after you are tasting the Amrit, why would you go to the... But like Alexander David Neal told the mother, I pray to the divine to help you. And she didn't say anything. After going, she laughed a lot. She said, she doesn't know. So you see, what can we really So you are so full, you are Nitya Yukta. On him is concentrated all his bhakti. He has no desires to hunger after. Again, child is with the mother. All that he needs, if at all, is to look toward the mother. But actually the mother already knows that this baby is going to get hungry. And she knows all the hunger. She knows when to satisfy. She knows when to not to do it. All that is needed is faith that we are with the divine. How beautiful life can become. For he possesses the highest and the all and is close to the all power that brings all fulfillment. He has no doubts or baffled seekings left. For all knowledge streams upon him from the light in which he lives. So you can be free of all books then. Then you go beyond the Shastra. Shabda Brahmati Vartate. Whatever you need to know, you will know. Whatever you need to do will be done. So this is the blissful state in which ultimately the Gita is striving to lead us and lift us up. He loves perfectly the divine and is his beloved. Look at this line. You ask the person, whom do you love most perfectly? The Lord. So if somebody goes and asks, Lord, whom are you loving? You will say, my bhakta. Such a bhakta, not every bhakta. Such a bhakta. So look at what is the expression that he is and is his beloved. That's why we see in Ramayana, there are two bhaktas. One of course is Ram and Hanuman on the earthly plane. Otherwise is Rama and Shiva. Shiva is constantly saying, Rama, Rama, Rama. So wonderful. And even Mata Sati can't make out why is he calling him Sachidanand Brahm. Look at him. He is striving, suffering, struggling like any mortal. You are the one who has taken poison. Don't you see? You are the greatest. He says he is taking poison every day of his life. You want to call me as the highest, but look at him. His whole life is a poison. And with smile he is taking it. That is bhakti. So this is where. For as he takes joy in the divine, so to the divine takes joy in him. It's something new, understanding of bhakti. Bhakti literally means from the root bhaj. Bhaj means to take joy. Tena tak tena bhunjate. Bhakti is not doing, you may do all this kirtan, bhajan mandali, but your mind may be for the prasadam or for something else, you may be thinking, that's not bhakti. Bhakti is to take joy in the divine, in his name, in his glory. And if you have it, you don't do anything formal, yet it is bhakti. And as you take joy in the divine is also taking joy in you. In fact, the real thing is the other way around. That you cannot think of the divine unless the divine thinks of you. So how beautiful this bhakti is. So different from all that we are traditionally accustomed to. I'll read this line again. And we'll stop with this. And this, he says, this is the God lover who has the knowledge, Jnani Bhakta. We'll stop with this line. He loves perfectly the divine and is his beloved. The Bhakta is the divine's beloved. For as he takes joy in the divine, so too the divine takes joy in him. You see Sri Aurobindo's correspondence with Nirodh Baran, with Dilip Kumar Roy. What jokes? Amrita, mothers dealing with Amrita. And you take joy in the divine also. He can joke with you. He can play with you. Even pranks. See Krishna, you see stories. And we'll close with this footnote, which is very important. So we spoke about the three inferior modes of bhakti. So do they vanish after you have discovered the divine everywhere in everything? Now this is unique. Sri Aurobindo is bringing it because it's not there in the Gita. There is a place also for the three lesser seekings even after the highest attainment. But transformed, not narrowly personal. For there can still be a passion for the removal of sorrow and evil and ignorance. So there is the earth. Lord, let this earth be healed. We see mother's prayers, 4th August 1914, when the world war breaks. She's praying for the whole earth, that it's in agony. So is she an Arth? It's a transformed Arth. She's already realized. Or Upanishad prayer, Sarve Bhavantu Sukhina, Sarve Santu Niramaya. And for the increasing evolution and integral manifestation of the supreme good, power, joy and knowledge in this phenomenal nature. So this is where he takes bhakti to the ultimate possible levels, beyond limits. Thank you. Jai Ma.